just in case your quarantine wasn't bad enough, this is me, Paul Podcast. I am back. I am going to be doing this now for a little bit. So me and Dan, we're going to continue to do our regular sort of review show that we do once a week. That's still happening. But what I'm trying to do right now is organise podcasts for the Holy Raw podcast. But I keep getting let down. I either can't fit into their time frame because of my work, or they can't fit into mine, even though we're on lockdown and everyone should be just at home doing nothing. So instead, I thought, what can I do in these periods where I've got like an hour spare here, hour there? I don't just want to be watching horror films all the time. So what I'm going to do is this. If you've clicked play, thank you very much. I really appreciate it. Let me go into a little bit of preamble, a little detail before we kick it off. So, about 18 years ago now, hang on, let me work that out. Yeah, that's right. About 18 years ago, I started writing a book, and it was a book about 1980s music, because that seems to be what I'm obsessed about, particularly 1980s pop music. At the time I started writing this, I was a bit of a freelance journalist working for various different online sources. And even though I enjoyed that, I particularly loved interviewing just anyone from the 1980s, which is why when you sort of look at back at the bands that I've interviewed and things like that, there I will pass up someone that I really love from this era of music just to speak to, like Alison Moyet, or speak to Boy George, Bob Geldof, whoever it was that was available at the time. They were the ones I would jump at rather than like my current heroes sort of thing. Even if I wasn't into their music, I'm just fascinated by 80s pop. And the reason is purely nostalgia. I was a small lad in Australia up until 1983, when my parents flew us out to the UK, because they're both UK. My dad was from London, Bethnal Green area, and my mum was from Kent. She was born in Medway, raised in a little village called Hollingbourne. And yeah, as soon as we sort of arrived in England, for some reason, my interest in music just triggered. It was 1983. As I say, I was really young, but it didn't matter that I was really young. I just discovered WH Smiths. I discovered John Menzies. I discovered like record shops for the first time. And the reason why I mention these news agents, first of all, of course, Woolies, is because they had the singles racks, and that was what I could afford to buy. My very first records that I bought was Wham's Club Fantastic Megamix and Culture Club's Karma Chameleon on the same day. I was so young, I just looked at the covers and loved them. I loved Boy George's face. I just thought, wow. So I bought that one, and I saw Wham on Top of the Pops, and I fell in love with their look. Their leather jackets really turned me on as a kid. I was like, yes, this is cool. Look how hard they are. So yeah, that's what I liked about Wham. I thought they were full of rebellion. So yeah, that's why I bought those two singles to start with. Every single week, I'll be able to afford one new single and one bin single. And by bin single, it means it's like an ex-jukebox single. So I would pay my like 99p for a proper single, or £1.49, whatever it was, with my pocket money. But I'd end up having £2 for pocket money each week. So my other 50p, yeah, it must have been that, my other 50p would go to one of these ex-chart singles that used to be in a jukebox. And I would just build up my collection. And before you knew it, I had this massive stack of singles, of which I've only got a few left, because I just sold them in bulk at one point in my life. But of course, these melodies, these times of my life, they've stuck with me. Not to bum everyone out, but there was a lot of issues going on at home. My dad was really abusive, and it was like my escape. Before I discovered horror movies as a teenager, music was just it for me, and I just delved into singles. I would tape every single day songs off the radio. At school, I was literally counting the minutes till I could go home and listen to more music. It was my life. I was totally obsessed. It was something where I could go and disappear and try and avoid the family and just bury myself in this other world that was so idyllic to me. So there you go, that's my background. That's where I was at a very young age, just coming into the UK. I didn't have any friends. My friends were the bands that I loved. My friends were the singers that I loved. My friends were the DJs that would play me my favourite tunes. I particularly liked Mike Reed for some reason. Goodness knows why at the time. I really liked the cut of his jib. Until, of course, he banned that Frankie Goes to Hollywood single, Relax. And that's when I just did not like it. I was like, why are you doing that? Why can't I listen to this? I didn't know what it was about. I was a kid. I just wanted to listen to what was number one. The guy was a buffoon in my eyes from that point. But yeah, as I say, I wasn't anywhere near 10 years old. So what do I know? So as I was saying, this is a book that I started writing and I never completed it. Basically, I took every year from the 80s, 1980 to 1989. I wrote my 40 best singles down, my 40 favourites and my 40 favourite albums down. And then what I did was I wrote about my life at the time. I wrote about these songs and what they meant to me. A little bit of info off Wiki or whatever I popped in there. And I discovered I wasn't that great a writer. I was okay. I'd read worse than what I could do, but I've also read a lot better. And to be a writer, even 15 years ago, you need to be a lot higher standard than what I was. So I knew my limitations, but it didn't really stop me. It was just a personal thing for me. So I just kept writing and kept writing. And what I've got left is just thousands and thousands of pages. Thousands of pages of text, thousands of pages worth of like little memories and things. So I'm going to put it all together here. I'm going to just dip in basically, and maybe this will be a long-term project. Maybe I'll just stop at what I'm going to do here. I don't know. It depends how you like it. Depends if I like recording it. I'd love to just have it for posterity, to be honest with you. It makes me think all that period of my life writing away wasn't wasted. But then why would you be interested in what I consider to be my favourite 40 songs? I don't know. But I've chosen 1983, as you can see by clicking what you've clicked. 1983 is where I'm going to start. I've chosen my 40 favourite singles at the time of writing. It's completely changed now, by the way. Even my number one isn't the same as what it was then, but I don't care. I'm going to stick to what's in the book. So with that all said, let's just say this is... I don't really know what to call this whole thing, so let's probably just say that this is the best songs from 1983, according to Paul. I think that'll do it. Okay, you ready? Let's do it. So at number 40, it's Bob Marley and Buffalo Soldier. This one came out on Island / Tuff Gong. And I didn't discover this song at the time, 1983. I discovered it a few years later, probably one re-released somewhere. It wasn't always in my head. But over the years, I've just grown to love it. Of course, I got that Legend compilation in my teens like everybody else did. And sort of listened to it to death. We're going to kick this off with a great little interview with Bob Marley from 1980. He was in Zurich at the time of recording this interview, a little while before his death.
In your songs, you often refer to the Bible, but many of the young people who are coming to your concert don't believe in the Bible anymore.
Because the way they've been taught about the Bible, that is not the way of the Bible. You know what I mean? Because if I was living in that world where the everyday interpretation of the Bible go on, then I would have eaten the Bible too. But now that we have found the right way of the Bible, then the Bible is to be loved, because the Bible is a record of man creation. It's the only book can make, can show you where mankind begin without any prejudice or anything like that, any boastiness, pride or anything. It just have how it go, and that's it. Mm-hmm. Well, all the Christian people, not even the Christian, all the people who go to churches interpret the Bible and the preach as them. That is not the right way. Because the greatest thing is that life, see, is life. Life I deal with. If the preacher read the Bible and tell you that you have to die to go to heaven, then he's not reading the Bible. Because the Bible tell you, you have to live in a heaven. You don't die and go to heaven, you have to live in heaven. You know, a lot of places on earth could be, but Africa is our heaven, because that's where we come from. You know, maybe if it's a Swiss, maybe if you're from Switzerland and the people know God, then maybe you could live in peace, unity, harmony, you know. But, you know, people are stubborn on this earth because of material vanity.
And there is the great man telling us to stop reading the Bible wrong. Okay, it's important. Don't read it wrong. Now, this song, Buffalo Soldier, was recorded shortly before his death. It was, in fact, in his final sessions in 1980. I reckon it's a fine testament to him. The thing about Bob Marley, he's everywhere. Like, I'll give you an example. Every single country that I've been to, there is murals on walls. There are, in fact, like, just a little quip. Like, I was in Florida many years ago doing Disney or something like that, and I remember there was the Bob Marley cafe that we went to. So his estate had their own sort of chain of restaurants in America, and it was proper average food, I can tell you that much. But yeah, just walking around, you would hear like him pumping out of like the tannoys that are going up, but you also heard things like Modest Mouse, so it wasn't all Bob Marley, but just one of those things, you know. He's everywhere, still to this day. One of the things you would often hear people say, and it's really true, like, you can silhouette maybe 100, maybe 200 people from history, you can silhouette them, and you'd be able to know who they are from that silhouette, no matter where you are in the world. And Bob Marley's one of them. Bob Marley is one of them. Now, when I talk about the charts, I'm usually talking about the English music charts, the ones that Gallup did. So bear that in mind. They're the ones that were on Radio 1. This single reached number 4 in the singles charts. And I would say it might be one of his most popular songs. And yet it didn't see a release until 1983, hence its entry here on my list. Now, a quick glance over Wikipedia will inform you of what it's about a little bit. Buffalo Soldiers originally were members of a 10th Cavalry Regiment of the United States Army, formed on September the 21st, 1866 at Fort Leavenworth in Kansas. The nickname was given to the Black Cavalry Soldiers by Native American tribes who fought in the Indian Wars. The term eventually became synonymous with all the African American regiments formed in 1866. So there you go, just talking about black soldiers and the nickname given to them by the Native American tribes. That's what it's about. Not something that I'd be that keen to write about in this day and age, that's for sure. Bit weird, but there you go, still a great tune. Now, before I play you it, I just want to play you some of this, right? Listen to this. That was the Banana Splits 1968 theme tune, the Tra-la-la song. Now, that way-yo refrain, it's just too close, right? It's too close. Something I guess we'll never know for sure is whether he, like, just completely ripped it off himself. I don't think it matters. I don't think it really matters too much. But I can't get it out of my head. Whenever I hear Buffalo Soldier now, I'm thinking of the Banana Splits. And I'm thinking to myself, well, maybe it was Ziggy. Maybe his son was just going, tra-la-la, la-la-la-la. And then he's influenced his dad like that, maybe. Maybe that's how it happened. I don't know. But anyway, you've heard it a million times, I imagine. And I guess with all these songs, you've heard it. But here it is. This is my number 40. This is Bob Marley and Buffalo Soldier. I think I'm going to do this podcast in four parts, but I might do it in two. But I'll give you my 40 to 21 rundown of what type of songs you're in for. So we've got one pop rock song, we've got one indie song, we've got one rock song, only one rock song, really sorry out there, one electronica song, we've got two reggae songs, of which you've just heard one, and 14 pop songs. So right now you're thinking, I think I'm going to turn off now. But if you don't, if you want to stick with me, good, good for you, good for you. So next up is number 39. Now, if there was ever an artist that you would be better off listening to in the form of a compilation, this next artist is it, I would tell you that much. It's Lionel Richie. The song that I've chosen at number 39 is All Night Long. In brackets, All Night. It came out on Motown Records. So in 1983, Lionel Richie is a solo artist. He hit pay dirt, like mega million selling Can't Slow Down, that album. I remember walking into shops and seeing his sort of funny face, his big teeth, his big moustache, and his sensible choice in clothing. And just thought, this is not for me. That's what I instantly thought. Even as a young kid, I knew that this guy was not going to be part of my life growing up. But there's no denying that this song, I don't know, did something to me as a child. And still now when I hear it, and I think this one is purely based on nostalgia because it is way overplayed. As I say, it does something to me. Eventually, I did get Can't Slow Down, and I've got to admit, I have quite the distaste for it. There's three awesome singles on it, I think, three great pop songs. Stuck on You is one of them, and whilst that is full-on sloppy sentiment gush, it is such a superior ballad to Hello, which came a few years later. I mean, you know Hello, the ridiculous video, the moulding of Lionel Richie's face in clay. Yeah, Hello. So if you think that that's brilliant, well, you're going to love Stuck on You if you're into that sort of mulchy, sloppy pop. Another good song on this album was Running with the Night. It had a more modern Motown flavour. Pumps along, it's like this thumping disco thing. But best of all on it is All Night Long, and which is why I've chose it. Debut single off this album. And as I said earlier, it's overplayed. It's something that's going to be overly familiar with all of you out there if you've got a radio and you've ever heard a radio on in the background, or you watch telly, which I imagine is a good 95% of people, they're just going to know this song back to front. And does it still pack a punch? In all honesty, I really couldn't say. It's just this nostalgic thing for me. And even as a young kid, I was pretty elitist. And when Hello came out, I thought, right, that's going to eclipse All Night Long. And All Night Long can be my song. And Hello can be their song, the other people's song. But it wasn't to be. And then growing up, Lionel Richie just took a complete back burner anyway. Was not into him in any way, shape, nor form. So let's play a bit of it. This is Lionel Richie's All Night Long.
Well, my friends, the time has come. Raise the roof and have some fun. Throw away the work to be done. Let the music play on, play on. Everybody sing, everybody dance. Lose yourself in wild romance. We're going to party, carnival, fiesta, forever. Come on and sing along. We're going to party, carnival, fiesta, forever. Come on and sing along.
And we're also going to just listen to Lionel, maybe just talk a little bit about where his head was at the time.
I always tell people the secret to writing is, they say, what do you think about? Don't think. Just let it come through. I didn't realize it at the time, but it was the greatest form of therapy I ever had in my whole life. Because things that I was feeling could actually be expressed in lyrics.
We're going to party, caramba, fiesta, forever. Come on and sing hello.
Now I have this song, well, my friends, the time has come to raise the roof and have some, that's great. Caramba, fiesta, forever. Come on and sing along. Ah, da, da, da. Come on and sing along. Da, 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 da. Come on and sing. I don't have a hook. And so it took me probably another month of just walking around my house and everywhere trying to find out what is the hook to come on and sing along. I've got to give you the sing along. So I went to one of my dear friends' houses, Dr. Lloyd Gregg. And I went by for dinner. He's from Jamaica. And I'm leaving it now. I took a break from the studio. I'm leaving his house now about 2 o'clock in the morning. And as I'm leaving the house, I'm saying to him, hey man, I got to go back and work all night long, man. All night long, all night long, all night long, all night long. Got it.
Now, listening to it on and on and on and on as I have for years, I think what I like so much about it isn't particularly the chorus. It's that smooth intro that just like all of a sudden belts into that chorus. It's the feeling of stepping into a party. And I guess, and I say guess because I'm not a party person, but I guess as a child, it's like what I thought would be cool about being an adult. Lionel Richie's All Night Long was like, oh, that's where it's at. When I'm an adult, I'm going to hey Jumbo Jumbo and I'm going to have some good party times. It never happened. And I think this song never offers up anything other than just having a good time. Like Cool and the Gang songs from this period as well. It's just all about partying and having a dance. And as a kid, I'm up for that. As an adult, I'm really not. Which is why it's so low down in my top 40. Final things I'm thinking of now, I've listening to it again just then. That middle eight where it sort of breaks down to the Hey Jumbo Jumbo bit, as I mentioned earlier there. It does slow the pace down a bit too much. But then that leads into the best bit of it where he goes, oh, we're gonna have a party. So I'm forgiving him for that. After that refrain, it's all forgiven. So that's my 39. That's Lionel Richie's All Night Long. Well then, this is number 38. This is The Kinks and Come Dancing. Or dancing, or dancing. But they want you to come and do it anyway. It's on Arista Records. Yeah, my number 38. So, they're well old, right? This is a well old band. But they did do an album. And off that album, they took this as a single. All the way back in 1983. But not as far as when they're at the heights in their late 60s. So a little background on how I got into the Kinks, and boy did I get into the Kinks. For a good few months I just devoured them, like all music fans do really. You just discover a band, maybe one track, one album, and it sends you on a path of obliteration and financial destitution. And unfortunately Kinks had one of them back catalogues which just went on forever. So yeah, cleared me out. But before I married her, my wife Claire, this is Claire my wife, because she said yes, so she married me. So yeah, she was a big indie head. So she had tons and tons of CDs. And of course, one of the first things you do when you get together is you ransack every single bit of music that they're into, that they've got, that you haven't got. And amongst all this stuff like Manson, Idlewild and all this Manic Street Preachers stuff, there was this Kinks compilation, and I think it was just like a best of, just a best of, nothing different than that. I'd never really had time for them before, but I gave it a spin just because I wasn't aware of them. I just knew a few of the big hitters that are on the radio or whatever. And one of the songs I absolutely loved was called Autumn Almanac. And I got to admit, I just love that so much. One of my favourite songs now of all time. I love Autumn Almanac. I just love the way that it transitions from the verse into the chorus and vice versa. But this isn't a podcast about Autumn Almanac. No, it's about the singles from 83. And one of them that come on was called Come Dancing. And it's this single, and it really stood out. And the reason it stood out is because, you know, sometimes you forget about a song. And then you hear it years and years later, and it just brings back a flood of memories. Well, that's what this was for me. So yeah, let me think. Autumn Almanac was 1967, off memory. Hopefully that's correct. Just the fact that I know that, although now I know one of you out there is going to prove me wrong. But you can see how much I really got into them, and like little odd facts stick into my head. And as I say, just remembering, like, where have I heard that before? Where have I heard that before? And, you know, just bang, and it all comes together. And it was just lovely listening to Come Dancing. Although, when you break it down, it is quite the cheesy pop song. It's weird when you look back at music, because Autumn Almanac from 67, it's only 16 years later that this one, Come Dancing, like, scraped into the UK top 20. And I've got to admit, knowing what I do now, they've got quite an interesting career trajectory. At this point in their career, the Kinks, at least in the UK, they could just do nothing, right? Their sales were well down. There was all these tensions in the band, just like always with them. And their fortune stateside, it was faring a bit better than here, but they had this reputation as an oldies band, much more so than they actually do now. Like, if the Kinks got back together now, it'd be huge. It would be absolutely huge. But it's not going to be, is it? Or is it? Is it? Is it? But over in the UK, at least they had this. It got them back into the charts. It got them on the radio again. I love it. Like, Come Dancing has got this lesson in lyrical storytelling. It's just like this is how you do it. Ray Davies is just on fire at this point. It's pure storytelling excellence. In the way that Morrissey would do it and embellish on it in a couple of years' time from this, Ray Davies is sort of like still got that knack of being able to do it. Reminiscing about a bygone era, of course. This one's about like the old dance halls before they got knocked down, and all the events that took place in there when he was a little nipper.
There was something that you mentioned fairly recently in a tape that we got here about writing Come Dancing.
Mm.
And when you couldn't come up with a verse, you would write a scene.
Oh, yeah. I do work with visuals. I've always done that. Yeah. I had it in mind to do it. It's a way of getting me through certain problems in a song. Come Dancing was easy. I did that one. I wrote it on a Friday and finished it on a Saturday, recorded it on the Monday. Uh-huh. It's great when it works like that, but it might have been in my head for a long time to do it, you see.
But even with like a decent storyline, decent lyrics, like if you haven't got a good song, just forget about it. And I think this one does. Like, it's got hooks all over the shop. It delivers completely, but only, and this is really, really important, it only delivers if you're in the mood for a happy song. And this one is ridiculously happy. It's got this sweet keyboard hook that just sticks in your head all day long. And the chorus, unfortunately, now it sort of grates on me a bit. I think maybe it grates on me because it's just easy. It seems so effortless and it works. It just slots into that song so easily. So have a listen. This is The Kinks and Come Dancing.
Of land where the supermarket used to stand. Before that they put up a bowling alley on the site that used to be the local pally. That's where the big band used to come and play. My sister went there on a Saturday. Come dancing, all our boyfriends used to come and call. Why not come dancing? It's only natural. Saturday, another date. She would be ready, but she'd always make him wait. In the hallway, in anticipation. He didn't know the night would end up in frustration.
So the album that this came from was called State of Confusion. The rest of this album, man, it's really poor. Don't like to diss such a thing, but yeah, it was really, really poor. And when I was collecting my Kinks albums, when I got to this one finally, it was pretty quick to be resold. Didn't like it at all. Very, very poor. Like, I don't want to just slag it off because it does contain this song, which I love. What other facts can I give you? Ray Davies, he was in the middle of a relationship with Chrissy Hynde from the Pretenders at the time. That's interesting, right? Is that interesting? But yeah, just going back to this album, like, how can you write a song as good, as interesting, as hooky, that completely delivers in a pop way, and just have one track like that in this album? It beggars belief. I don't understand it, because clearly you've got the skill, you can do it, and you can still do it. I, for one, am glad that this was still left in them as a final burst, because since then as well, I don't think Ray Davies has done anything that really excites me. But saying that, I've only listened to a couple of releases he's done since 83, so I'm not really the best one to do it. And when I did see him perform supporting Bob Dylan, I think it was at Hop Farm in Kent somewhere, But yeah, when I saw Ray Davies, he was, you know, it was interesting. The crowd loved it. It was reasonably good, and I really liked it, the cut of his jib. He had a lot of spunk about what he was saying, like slagging off Bob Dylan while he was on stage. Was great. I like that. And then like Bob Dylan had to follow that. Like Ray Davies was just like taking the piss out of him for living in a gated community, which I thought was quite nice. Quite a nice touch. Now, I'm sure you've already heard this, but this one is nowhere near as successful as Lionel Richie and nowhere near as successful as Bob Marley, the two songs that I've mentioned already. So all I would say is if you don't know it, and you did enjoy that like minute that I played, definitely dig it out and it's worth it. But if you're not going to do that, if you think, oh, that's a bit shit, compared to the rest of the best of the Kinks, this is a bit shit. Like, the Kinks are a bona fide classic band that deserve your attention. Like, absolute killer songs. And not remembered, unless you're like a reader of Mojo, they're just not remembered in the same way like the Beatles and the Stones are, and they fucking should be. All right, so that was my number 38. That was the Kinks and Come Dancing. And this one is the Police and the song Synchronicity 2. It came out on A&M Records. It's my number 37, as I've already said. And it's probably, so far, out of the four, the only one that I still listen to on the reg. So, like, still listening to this one. Whenever it comes on, I crank it and I love it. It's not embarrassing for me. It's not a guilty pleasure at all. None of that. And it's not because I'm reminiscing about the good old days. I just genuinely think this song is sick, as the youth calls it. So this is the one where mainly whenever I think of it I think of the video. It would seem like Duran Duran borrowed the whole of the Wild Boys video set directly from Synchronicity 2's shoot, and then all they've done is they've just added that windmill that Simon Le Bon's like ticky taped to, and you know, so he can get his wet hair dripping across his face shots on. Like, apart from that, I would say this set is pretty much identical. It's just that Duran Duran ramped it up to 10, whereas Sting and the Police Boys are just, you know, coasting on 9. But what the Police got that Duran Duran don't have is they've got toilet roll flying about. And that is why I can remember this so vividly, is just Sting dodging toilet roll everywhere, just flying everywhere. Obviously it's aided by wind machines, and it's weird. Like, in today's day and age, when we're so desperate for toilet roll, wow, what a waste. I mean, it is utterly ridiculous whichever way you look at it, but I find it brilliant at the same time. I just totally love the 80s and sort of that pompous waste of money that the record labels had at their disposal just to throw at any band. So this lush and extravagant and no doubt incredibly expensive video just always sticks in my mind. Also, this has come from the album Synchronicity. The title song Synchronicity is all right. Like, it's not perfect, it's all right. But Synchronicity 2 for me is like definitely the darkest track taken from it. It's a complete belter. Now, looking through my book, it goes on about how Sting took up the theme of Synchronicity after reading Carl Jung's writings on the subject, in a similar way to the way that Sting adopted Ghost in the Machine for the Police's previous album, when he was exploring the works of philosopher Gilbert Ryle and the author Arthur Koestler, I think is how I would pronounce that. I have no idea what I'm talking about. You're right there, Puggles. Mr. Puggles is on my lap currently sleeping, so if you can hear him snoring away, do apologise. But, you know, he's more important than both me and you. Now, it's weird, like, for the layman such as me, such as myself, like, normally anything like that, and pretty much anything to do with Sting, like, just reeks of pretentiousness, and it's just one step removed from Bono and, like, that opportunist dribble that that guy comes out with.
The thing you're asking me to do is like explain a joke.
Yeah, I know. Once you don't.
I spent a lot of energy and a lot of skill putting my thoughts into the form of a song.
Yeah.
It's in a symbolic metaphor, if you like.
Yeah.
Now you're asking me to unravel it and give it to you on a plate.
I'm lazy, you know.
In a sense, I'm unwilling to do that, and it's not really part of my job.
No, I know.
In a nutshell, my work concerns loneliness and isolation, and the kind of thing that we have in common is this isolation. It's the paradox of being alone, and yet alone with everyone else.
Mm.
That's it in a nutshell, but I wouldn't sit and explain to you my songs.
Right. I thought you, once being a teacher, could feel the pedagogic aspect.
I wasn't a pedagogue, I was a teacher. And I mean, I think I still am a teacher.
Yeah.
And a good teacher is someone who...
makes his pupil think.
Yes, throws you hints.
But I sort of see Sting as an English eccentric, rather than too ridiculously po-faced, like nowhere near on Bono's level, I don't think. So that was Synchronicity 2 by The Police. Now, lyrically, I have no idea what it means. I mean, I'm none the wiser to what this is about. Slight mentions a Loch Ness monster. I mean, I've had worse ideas, to be honest. But whatever the connotations behind this prose that Sting was laying on his audience at the time, this is definitely, for me, The Police's final classic single. A band that's got so many, it's crazy. Sting never equaled this. In my eyes, throughout his solo career, time and time again, whenever he attaches his name to anything, it makes me cringe these days. And even for the last 20 years, if I'm going to be honest, probably before that, let me think. Yeah, probably 30 years. So that's it. That was my number 37. That's The Police and Synchronicity 2. And now this...
Get ready, get on your feet, get into gear and hit the street.
Hey, you!
Get moving, it's not too far, you're looking good, so come as you are.
Hey, you!
You never know what you see when you're through that door with the 7-3.
Never seen nothing, no, not like this place. Never been, no, no way, not ever, no. Never seen no place, no way, similar, not like 73.
Hey, you, get ready, get on your feet, get into gear and hit the street. It's you that we want to see, so get down to 73. Get down to 73, hey, you, get down to 73.
Oh, brilliant.
Thank you.
Have you found, actually, that video boom in the pop industry has changed the way that you write now?
Not the way you write, but the way you promote records. Because, especially in America, there's a station called MTV, which is just 24 hours a day, just plays video. And it really helps to sell singles, especially by groups like Duran Duran. British groups have really happened because of MTV, a lot to do with MTV. And it's really, you have to make an album, then you have to promote it, then you have to make a video.
Yeah.
It's really necessary.
Uh-huh. Is there any songs in the past that, out of any of your old hits that you do revise again, just especially for video format?
I don't know. Candle in the Wind or something.
Yeah.
Like that. But it's just an obvious way to do that.
Yeah. So there you go. That was the intro to a programme that I watched a lot when I'd first come over to this country. It's a program, probably you could guess from the title of it, called Number 73. And it's a program where Sandy Totsvig of the Bake Off fame and QI fame, that's where she got her start. And that's how I remember her anyway, from me being a toddler. And what's interesting, that whole episode is available on YouTube if you want to watch it. Put a little snippet of Elton John there talking about his videos. There is definitely some vacuum going on in the background. There is definitely Mr. Puggles snoring on my lap. So again, really sorry if all these things are putting you off. Where was I? I was talking about Number 73. So Number 73 sort of played a big part of my youth. I think what Number 73 was it was a sort of like a cross between a real shit sitcom and a pop program where they would have people round for tea, famous people like Elton John, like this episode. So if you want to watch the whole thing, as I say, it's on YouTube, half an hour of your life you'll never get back. And I think on that one they were talking about his song before it, I guess why they call it the blues. But I can tell you, when we landed, so this is an interesting story, not really funny, but the reason why I'm including I'm Still Standing on here is this. It's not one of my favourite songs by Elton John. My favourite song by Elton John might be Daniel. It might be that one that goes ding 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 ding. And that's got no voice in it at all. I quite like your song. There's a few. And I haven't really ever dug deep on Elton. Maybe I will one day. But I don't really like his singles too much. But the reason why this is there is because when we immigrated, which was August of 83, we heard this song everywhere. It was in the airport in Australia. And I remember this really clearly of annoying my parents because I was singing I'm Still Standing as a little kid. It was so infectious. And who knows, maybe I'd heard of it before as we were leaving Australia. Maybe it was out early, I don't know. But anyway, I just remember that being in my head. And this is why I'm so fond of it. And we also heard it from a taxi coming from Heathrow, going to my nan's where we lived for a few months. And the funniest thing was that night when we got in and we'd all sat down by the telly, it was Top of the Pops. And when it was switched on, it was bang. Just one of them few memories that I have from my early childhood where it's very distinct. I can remember looking in the taxi, listening to Elton John, looking out the window and seeing the signs in London that said to let, and I just thought they'd spelt toilet wrong. I was a child and I can't remember her look, but I imagine it was one of utter confusion and thinking I'm an idiot. I mean, who doesn't know this song? These days, I'm Still Standing must be one of Elton's signature tunes. And as a follow-up to that successful, I guess why they call it the blues, it couldn't have been further from that. It's a pretty good choice. Solid to do an up-tempo, pompy pop song. I mean, I don't have many facts and figures about this at all. I do remember that when I used to go and see Chelsea Football Club, whenever they lost, which was probably every single time I went, I didn't go very often, but I do remember they would play that after a game and it would sort of pump up the crowd ready for the next game, which I quite liked. I quite like that feeling of being part of something and like not being too bummed out that we just lost those 3 points. But one thing I can tell you about it is the album that it come from, Too Low for Zero. This album spawned a few decent singles, but really it is full of filler. It's quite the horrid listen and it's really difficult to listen to. So my recommendation is that you never do that. And pretty much after that, to be honest with you, there's no decent Elton John albums that came out. Even single wise, there's nothing much to report. Like, Elton John isn't for me. As I said at the beginning of this, I do give him like a little bit of cadence for having like the song Daniel. Love that. I don't mind Benny and the Jets. Nikita, I really like, which was a song that came out after this, but that was his last good one for me. And of course, whatever that one is that goes do 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 do. It's number 36. That's Elton John's I'm Still Standing. So just before we go on, I just want to mention, if you can hear a fly in the background, I don't know what's happened. It's like a suicidal fly is coming from another room and he keeps bashing into my window trying to get out, and the poor thing cannot get out at all, and he's definitely giving himself a bit of a headache. But if you hear him, yeah, it's my new friend, Philip the Fly. Wow. Okay, next up, 35, Heaven 17 and Come Live With Me. This came out on Virgin Records. And Heaven 17, as anyone that knows them will know, they are probably more famous for their big smash hit Temptation that come out a bit later on in that year. And I would also say that if you're a fan of the Human League, well, when they split originally, because Human League did have a sort of really hip and underground career before they went big with Don't You Want Me Baby, and the parent album Dare. So yeah, they split up, and Phil the singer, he found a couple of young girls in a nightclub that were sort of scenesters at the time and asked them to join. That's how the legend goes. I imagine it's true. Why would anyone lie to us? And as I just said, they had a massive, massive successful album with Dare and the single Don't You Want Me, which is something like their fourth single, but we're not talking about that. It's weird how you release an album like Dare and then you think, well, single number one, that'll do it. Single number two, maybe that'll do it. Oh, let's give up single number three. And the record company says, actually, try Don't You Want Me. And that's the one that broke them. That's mad, mad, mad. And the other part of the band, they left the Human League and they become Heaven 17. Now, this song, Come Live With Me, it's a strange, strange beast. It's a bit of a ploddy song. It's quite mid-tempo, and the vocal delivery of Glenn Gregory, it's at places, it seems a bit half-hearted, more spoken rather than sung. But I quite like that unattractive nature of it. I like that it's a bit dour. And especially when you get the message of that band was giving at the time. The look as a kid really was unappealing to me, so I never went for them. It was like they were in business suits or they wore like long coats, like pervy old men. And it's something that as a kid, you don't want that. You want Boy George, you know what I mean? You would want the Human League. You wouldn't want this. But I can see Heaven 17 definitely had an audience. And even I, as a kid, bought this. I loved Come Live With Me, I really did. And I'd say, going out on a bit of a limb here, I would say from all the songs that we've played so far, this one still sounds a bit current, like retro futuristic in its sound palette. I do say that, but then when you add the like lyrics, it's more pervy old men stuff. Like, I was 37, you were 17. You were half my age, the youth I'd never seen. It makes matters worse for them. Especially in this day and age, especially in that day and age. And of course, like, when you read that line, the maths is also wrong. Like, if that was coming out today, I'll tell you, there would be an outcry. It would not wash. But as I mentioned earlier, there was a political side to this band that there wasn't with other pop music. And of course, it washed over my head as a kid. But to throw some more light on it, to throw an enlightenment upon the record from which this single has come, here's a little snippet of an interview from them at a time.
All right, now, I have a few questions for these guys. Ian, you are a politically oriented band. Now, what I wanted to know is, do you guys consider yourself political in the same sense as The Clash, and what are your politics?
Not quite in the same sense as The Clash. I think The Clash are pretty didactic. They try and force it down people's throats, and generally they're preaching to the converted. They're like talking to people who are already into that sort of thing, and it seems fairly pointless to me, whereas our approach is a little softer, a little more subtle maybe, but in doing so we probably reach more people who wouldn't necessarily think like that in the first place, but eventually if they get around to reading the lyrics, maybe they will come over to our point of view.
Okay. Very nice. Well spoken. Okay, Martin, in as much as you guys are not big fans of big business industry, that sort of thing, how do you think it's going to affect you guys if you become very successful, which it looks like you're on the verge of doing, making a lot of money within the system that you supposedly are working to change?
It is a difficult one, I admit, and we've put a lot of thought to this in the many interviews we've done in the last few days. And the best answer we can come up with is we'll put it all into films.
Okay. Glenn, you want to tell us about the new album?
Yeah, maybe. I don't know. Yeah. Hi, everybody. Yeah, the new album, The Luxury Gap. There it is. Buy it. It was recorded in about a three-month period, starting off with little tea mornings that we used to have, where Ian and Martin would come round to my flat, and I'd have little sandwiches made, and tea or coffee, and we'd chat, and we'd got a little Dr. Rhythm at that time, which is a little drum machine, and a couple of Cassiotones, and they'd, you know, we'd kind of work out little songs as we were drinking tea.
Do you all write the songs equally?
Absolutely, yeah. We write the music's first, and then the lyrics come right at the very last.
Mm-hmm. So there you have it. And yeah, I also think that that song Temptation, I didn't like it at the time. I didn't like the sort of creepiness of that single. I much preferred the Come Live With Me. I much preferred it. But Temptation was the one where Heaven 17, they were all the time on the radio. It sort of overtook when radio was massive compared to what it is today. Absolutely massive. I always remember the female backing singer, higher and higher. And that was like, it was grated worse than my version just did. It was horrific to me as a kid. I really didn't like it. Whereas the melody here, the melody with Come Live With Me, it attaches itself to that part of my brain that tickles all my pleasure receptors. It's one of those things that just really grows and grows because it's so subtle, and yet there's a thickness to it. And of course now, I didn't see it back then, but there's that adultness of the band that just makes it think, yeah, this is proper pop. Something I didn't realise until this weekend, I was watching Clockwork Orange, and in that film they mention the word Heaven 17 are a couple of ladies and our lead protagonist in the film. They're going through record stacks and they mention the Heaven 17s. And I thought, oh, hello. And then I looked it up, and yes, that is where the name came from. So that's sort of interesting, right? That's about it for my facts. There's probably a lot more to say about them, but as I say, they're not one of the bands that I come back to a lot. This is a single. If you don't know it, it's one that I still truly love. This is Come Live With Me.
Remembrance of those days, at least place there's no submission to heart's treason. Here today, my tomorrow. No more shame, only sorrow. All that kissing, there's something missing.
There you go. That was Heaven 17 and Come Live With Me at number 35. So, what was the biggest selling 12-inch of all time? And each copy that it sold, it made a loss. Every time you bought it, it cost them money. How about this one? It invented crossover indie dance with this unique use of electronic beats and rhythms. Bloody, 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 blah. So that's my number 34, New Order's Blue Monday. And yeah, another common assumption that is always brought up with this record is that Kraftwerk was such a heavily influenced. And there is no mistaking that when you listen to this song by New Order that you can hear Kraftwerk all over it. Something I completely disagree with. Where they both sort of meet and where they match a little bit, I guess, is sometimes Kraftwerk can come across as a little bit melancholy, and definitely like New Order, they come across as almost depressing, especially since most of the band members have come from Joy Division, such a bleak and oppressive band. In fact, here is what they had to say about it.
Do you find it ironic at all that because of the mainstream chart success, a lot of people have only just discovered you will consider you to be a dance band or a disco band?
Categorisation is something that happens afterwards, and you don't sit down and think, right, we'll write a chart hit now, or we'll write a disco song. You just write what you feel like. Yeah. I mean, if that's got in the charts and disco people buy it, then maybe they'll buy disco people. Yeah, there you go, categorisation. I don't know what a disco person is.
All said, though, amongst all this myth, amongst all this legend, this song, Blue Monday by New Order, this is a classic, and it's a classic for very good reason. It's not all that other stuff. It's such a great song. It's such an earworm once it hits you, and it's not instant. If you are, like I was, very much a musical novice, like I was when I was a kid, then yeah, you are going to find this weird as hell. You're going to find it bleak, maybe because of Bernard's vocal delivery during it. It's very unusual for for someone that's been listening to like Howard Jones and whatnot. But like, who is bored of those opening beats? Who? Nobody can be bored of those. They're so good. And that chilling process choir that fuels the crescendo, the climax of this song, it's so good. The reason why it doesn't get a higher position than number 34 in my charts is because of these weirdo sound effects that they use during the song. Now, so I think sometimes, like, I wouldn't be surprised if you can hear a cow mooing or a dog barking. It seems farcical, like comical to me that they would use these sounds. And as mentioned before, that Bernard's delivery is, I think, what keeps this song, from dating. Like, the music itself, yes, that is dated, but when you add it to that drawl, that that downbeat vocal delivery, it still gives me chills. It still gives me chills when I listen to it. You put that on a decent pair of headphones and you pump it up into your head, you're going to know that you are in the presence of like some real diaphragmatic presence. It's bleak as hell. Have I said bleak? I think I've said bleak. And like, I'm going to finish here just by saying you've got to catch that Top of the Pops performance, which I think now is probably as famous as the song itself. So I'm sure you would have already seen it, where Bernard's vocals are way too high in the mix. And I can just see people's parents at that time watching Top of the Pops in 1983 listening to that and just thinking, what the hell has happened to music? It's a sort of cliche thing where parents would be throwing any items, any objects next to them at the TV saying, get this shit off my telly. And if you haven't seen it, you'll watch it and you'll know exactly what I mean. It's real jarring, especially if you've seen the episode in full. It's so jarring and utterly fantastic at the same time. So there you go. That's my number 34. That was New Order and Blue Monday. That is definitely one of the sort of standout moments of 83, if you think of Top of the Pops. Another one, though, is my number 33. So this is Wham's Club Tropicana. It came out on Innervision Records, a label that they ridiculously signed a crazy contract with, couldn't get out of it, cost them a ton of money, and it meant that they had to release a song that the band did not want at all to come out, called Club Fantastic Megamix. And that was the first single I ever bought, along with Karma Chameleon by Culture Club. Little factoid. So there we go. But yeah, that enduring image I mentioned, that is Club Tropicana's video on Top of the Pops. It's absolutely etched into my memory of what a wonderful and like almost mystical thing that I was looking at. It's like, what the hell? Where are they? I've just come from an Australian peninsula town, come straight over to sort of leafy suburbs in Kent. So I had it quite good, but nothing prepared me for watching this Wham thing. My word, like Club Tropicana, you want to mix that, match that up with Duran Duran's Rio. And yeah, you've got a picture there of the 80s in a nutshell, really. It's what people think of is those two videos. And looking back, it was at this moment, Club Tropicana's release, where George Michael, he became a sex symbol to the point where there was no denying that he was a legit sex symbol, not just a one-off, not just a one-hit wonder. He and also Andrew Ridgeley as well, let's face it, they were a duo. They had their own strips in like smash hits, comic strips, where it was like the rise of Wham. This is how they got together. They were always on the front pages. They were in the newspapers all of a sudden. They were everywhere. And like, they were gathering a lot of steam. So I found this clip on YouTube where both Andrew and George talk about that a little bit. Have a listen.
How do you cope with being treated as the sex symbols by all the 13-year-olds?
Coping with it. It's, as long as I think, if you deal with it in the perspective of being a pop star up on stage, and don't drag it into your private lives, I think you get a good balance. The audience expects performance, so we perform and we enjoy performing.
It's a big laugh, you know. We don't get up there and say, look at us, you know, aren't we sexy and everything. We do, but I mean, it's a joke, you know. We see the funny side of it.
George, have you made a lot of money?
No, not really. And what money we've made, we probably won't get to see because it gets spent before you get to see it. There are certain reasons why we haven't made anything like as much money as most people would probably believe, but you know, we're certainly not short of a few bob.
Now, the style of this song was also a departure from Wham's previous sound. It had a far more mature, classic pop groove, and a lyric that was not Bad Boys. It was just a sunny invitation to join that club 18 to 30 holiday culture. So, you know, the ideas were far grander than just having a ruck in a back alleyway. Well, that was the impression I got anyway when I was listening to Young Guns Go For It. That was the song itself, Club Tropicana. I'm sure you are no stranger to that song, let's be honest. And yeah, looking back, there isn't anything too groundbreaking, except for the album that it came on. It was like the standout single. It was an obvious single. But when you compare it to like the other hype bands and the hype songs that were coming around at the time, you got things like Roman Holidays, Don't Try and Stop It. And whilst that's fine, that's a good song, like, you can tell that George Michael's got far grander vision of things. He's got a far wider palette to choose his musical weapons with. And he's only 20 years old at the time. He could hold these notes with, like, stunning maturity, which I think for me, like, during the Wham era anyway, because I wasn't really into solo George Michael, to be honest, but his first solo thing that he did, like A Different Corner, like official solo, that is, that was when he hit that perfect time for me. Like A Different Corner, his voice was just so perfect. And for Club Tropicana, this was the first inkling that he had that in him. On a side note, it was very interesting at the time, maybe even just 6 months after this, I remember that all the girls would be on the playground and they would actually be arguing about who was best, Wham or Duran Duran, and it was sort of drawing that line that if you're a Whammy or if you're a Durani, you couldn't be both. For me, not being female, I was quite happy to be both. I got a lot out of both bands. I think if you would make me choose, I'm going to go with Duran Duran every day, but there's no denying for me, Wham were a huge, huge thing. You could compare it to the Blur Oasis thing. Where it differs, I think, is this, that the Blur and Oasis thing was more of a teenage thing, and this Wham thing was like the 8 to 12 year old sort of thing. It was a real battleground on that playground, that's for sure. Number 32 now. 32, we've got Mike Oldfield and his song Moonlight Shadow. Of course, this came out on Virgin Records. It takes me straight back to a time listening to this when I just arrived in the UK. I was staying at my nan's until my parents found a place to settle. And I think it was maybe my third record, maybe my second record, like vinyl LP that I bought, was Hits on Fire, which was a compilation album from Ronco. There was a ton of these at the time, but my very first one was Hits on Fire, and it had this Moonlight Shadow song on it, and I loved it. I used to listen to it repeatedly. That was Mike Oldfield's Moonlight Shadow. He's best known, of course, for his instrumental work, and especially on Tubular Bells. But at the time I was a kid, I knew nothing of this. Like, I never understood why a female's voice belonged to a man called Mike. That got me. I was always wondering why that was. But saying that, not a lot of music at that time made it much sense to me anyway. Like, Culture Club introduced me to gender bending at such an impressionable age. Like, I just didn't really focus that much on, like, a boy having the attitude of a man's a man and all that sort of thing. It didn't interest me. I remember actually asking my mum, why don't boys sing about kissing boys? And why don't girls sing about kissing girls? I didn't get, like, what the difference was. And I remember her saying, it's just not done, Paul. It's not done. So, yeah, okay. The voice here that carries this song, Moonlight Shadow, it belongs to Maggie Riley. Now, she continued to collaborate with Mike Oldfield for a year or so more. But when I looked her up online, I found out she only had, like, this relatively unsuccessful solo career. And this was definitely the highlight, the standout, the only song that really sold a bunch.
Mike, Moonlight Shadow, which we heard a little snatch of a minute or so ago, you don't sing on that, but do we hear you playing on that?
Yes, I'm playing just about everything on it, and also I wrote all the music and wrote all the words, and I engineered it along with the help of an assistant engineer and produced it with a co-producer. But it really is my song, which I organised and recorded also at my own home in my own studio. I have a studio in one end of the house.
And whilst most people will think straight away of Mike Oldfield, they'll just think of Tubular Bells. And don't get me wrong, I love The Exorcist and I know that back to front. I love the music from that. I get it. But for me, Mike Oldfield is Moonlight Shadow. And as you heard, it's just folky pop. There's nothing unusual, nothing weird about it. It does sort of stand out amongst all these songs I've played before. Maybe a little bit boring when you hear it today. But at the time, the chart position was almost unprecedented for such a song. And one of the little tidbits that I got from it was that Virgin Records insisted to Mike Oldfield that he had to write a bucket load more of these because it was doing so well all over Europe. It charted here in England at number 4. And whilst there is lots of elements on it that are dated today, like the production still to me sounds incredibly fresh. The melodies from its opening bars to the fade out, they're all infectious. And I love the lyrics, even though they're pretty vague. It doesn't really matter. It's just the song is the best sort of nothing song. Do you know what I mean? It's just it doesn't offend. It's there. It's background music. And yet there is that something special that just drags me back all the time. Like, as soon as I hear it, it instantly takes me back. I instantly get that little tingle, that little remnants of, when I was younger, I used to listen to this, I used to put it. It's just nostalgia-based. So, again, maybe this song doesn't deserve to be as high as I put it, but I can't help myself. It is what it is, and it's my chart. Rumour had it that Oldfield's inspiration for this track was the shooting of John Lennon at the Dakota Building. But when he was probed about it in an interview, his explanation was that it was actually based around Tony Curtis movies, in particular Houdini. But whatever the truth, it doesn't alter the fact that this has become like an easy listening radio staple. You will hear it today as background noise on all the shitty radio stations. It's just one of those things. Still raking the guy cash in. But this is one time where they do have it right, I think. I do love this song. Now, before we go into my number 31, I just wanted to bring this up. So it's just come out today. Obviously, out there, there are better podcasters than me. And one that is way better than me is Adam Buxton. Now, Adam Buxton has today just put out a bunch of his favourite songs over the 80s. And I'm going to just dip a little bit into his 83. I'm going to give you a little rundown of his favourite songs that come out that time. So we're going to begin with Men at Work and Overkill, which I think is a classic. Flash in the Pan, Waiting for a Train, even better. Also Jean-Michel Jarre and Oxygen Part 4's there. Styx, horrible song, Mr. Roboto, is there. Don Henley, Dirty Laundry, I don't know that. I think I might have to play a bit of that so I know it. Synchronicity 2 is there. Lionel Richie's All Night Long, that is there. Yes, Owner of a Lonely Heart, that is also there. New Order, who we just talked about, Blue Monday, that's there. Susie and the Banshees and Dear Prudence. We Are Detectives, another awesome song, that's by the Thompson Twins. Rip It Up by Orange Juice, that is there, and I am not a fan of that at all. Now, I don't know this band at all, so I'm going to play this one a little bit of it anyway. Doot Doot by Fruer. Interesting. The Beat, Can't Get Used to Losing You. Central Line, Nature Boy. Now, I'm interested in this. I don't know this at all. I'm going to play a little bit here. Love. like that. And then we're going to finish up with The Police and Miss Gradenko. So that's Dr. Buckle's 1983 favourites there. He's just put that playlist up on Spotify. So by all means, write in Dr. Buckle's 1983 favourites and that will pop up and you can have a listen and you'll probably like it as much as I do. As I mentioned at the beginning, I only have one rock song and this is it. So at number 31 is Kiss and Lick It Up. Came out on Vertigo Records in the UK. Now, being the band that I fell in love with first, Kiss hold a real special place in my heart. It would be unfair to say that I don't hold a bias towards them, because I completely do. It's fully evident because they're in this chart. And for anyone else that was around England in 1983 that loved pop, this would not be there. But I can't lie to you. Like, this is my 31st favourite pop song of 1983. Now, this was written by the new band member Vinnie Vincent at the time, and then you would sprinkle some Paul Stanley's Kiss fairy dust lyrically and sonically on this, and Lick It Up has just become this staple in Kiss's live set to this day. Now, if you're thinking of a fan favourite song of theirs from their non-makeup era, so 1983, for the rest of the 80s, then I would say Lick It Up is probably the one that everyone would know if you weren't from the UK. If you were from the UK, you're going to go for either that Bill and Ted one from the 90s, God Gave Rock and Roll to You, or you're going to go to 87's Crazy Night. But if you're not from the UK, I think you're going to love Lick It Up. That's the one that you're going to go to. So as I mentioned, they had just taken their makeup off, and all the interviews around this time were exactly the same, and they pretty much still are exactly the same now. But here's a little thing from 1983 when the boys were over in England.
When you took your makeup off, there was a whole generation of new metal groups who moved into that position and took up where you'd left off, people like Motley Crue. Is that kind of thing flattering?
Yeah, sure absolutely. It is. Sure.
Because those bands eventually are either going to live or die by their own devices, their own talent. It's great.
Every band is initially influenced by others, but...
I thought we were going to say every band is eventually influenced by us.
But I tell you, it makes me sleep real well knowing that nobody ever accuses us of being like a Kiss copy. You know, we're not a Kiss copy band. We never have to worry about it.
I mentioned Motley Crue because there's this movement at the moment in America to try and instate certificates on LPs to make sure that LPs by people like Motley Crue do not get sold to minors because they're considered to be corrupting. Do you think that's a good idea at all?
I think everybody should be. If a miner can buy one, then pipe fitters can buy one.
Do you call them miners here?
Not.
I don't think they call it miners. A miner is somebody that goes underground. And, yes. So do you feel that Kiss are being seen as grandfathers of this this movement that's corrupted the youth of a once great nation?
I think the most positive effect we've had is we've increased the population of every country we've been to, and that's okay.
So, chanting chorus, check. A chugging, catchy rhythm in the verse, check. Direct sexual perversion beyond that of even Whitesnake in the lyrics, check. Here it is. This is Kiss's Lick It Up. Now, this, they thought, was an instant hit. They thought this was going to smash it. This was going to keep them up with those Motley Crues. This was going to keep them up with those Van Halens. And it didn't happen, although I think the song deserves that spot. Unfortunately, this time, Kiss's fortunes were middling at best, and this song failed to break even the American top 50. And if it wasn't bad enough, this follow-up, All Hell's Breaking Loose, the next single taken from this Lick It Up album, didn't chart at all. It was nothing. It was nowhere. It was just floppy flop Mixville. I mean, to be honest, Kiss's whole career was considered down at that time. They were considered dinosaurs, and that was 1983. Like, they're still going now. Like, admittedly, final tour, well, one of them, but back in 1983, they were considered dinosaurs. But as often as is the case with Kiss, their image overtakes the actual music, and even with its flawed sexual imagery, like, Lick It Up, I think, is today a modern rock standard. Like, it's modern day rock standard. I think it should have been far more successful than it actually was, but as is often the case with these guys, like, they're their own worst enemies, as you heard in that interview. Like, just idiots, just absolute twat faces. I mean, this band, even at this point, takes so many ludicrous career choices. Like, that just absolutely foolish things in hindsight, and yet they always try and back them up with their macho bravado. It's so embarrassing. You can see why they are the butt of so many jokes. In fact, I would recommend that you read a book, whether you're a Kiss fan or not. It's unofficial, and it's by C.K. Lent, L-E-N-D-T. The book's called Kiss and Sell, and it goes through all the stuff that the band would rather you didn't know. It's a real eye-opener, and it tells you, it sort of explains the way a rock band would generally function. And it was a real eye-opener for me, because everything that I always suspected was true, like, is not just verified here, but there's dates, there's facts, there's figures, there's documentation to prove it all. It's just such an eye-opener of, like, wow, like, that's incredible. It really is an eye-opener. So, yeah, Kiss and Sell. Have a read. Saying all that negative stuff, Kiss are still, for if I want to go to a cock-rocky type band, they're still my number one. I would still listen to them more than most, and they rock more than most. You strip away all that other shit. You strip away all the image. You strip away all that cheese. Then you're left with, like, I would say at least 30 killer songs, and there is so few bands out there with that. So there we go, that's the end of the first part of my book. 1983 singles, that was number 40 to number 31. Whenever Daniel feels ill again or is unable to do it because of crap going down in his house, maybe it's something that I can't do. I basically will build these up over weeks and then put them out. But I'll only put them out when we can't actually physically get together, like now in the lockdown, or if there's something just stopping us from getting together. If you get a chance, can you go to Apple Podcasts, leave us a 5-star review, even a little, like, a little note to say that you enjoyed it or you hated it, whatever. But more importantly, just be safe out there and, like, obey the arrows in supermarkets, for goodness sake. It's not hard to follow those arrows, come on.